moment of consideration, and then a sudden, overwhelming hunger. The walls blurred, and then there was an opening in the center of the floor, a pit that went deep. He remembered the impressions he'd gotten from the broken map Osriel had left behind. Subject One waited in a deep chamber at the center of the labyrinth. Linden didn't know if this tunnel led all the way there, but it was certainly the right direction. Rhaegon Shen laughed and strolled over to the lip of the hole, sheathing his sword as he walked. "Don't worry, humans. Tiberian will rest in peace." He paused and looked to Aethon. "Because I will fulfill his dream." Then he dropped into the abyss. The floor immediately shifted and closed up around him, the entrance vanishing. Osriel's workshop was now left with the sounds of failure, groans, harsh breathing, the slosh of water, and the distant hiss of Madra dissolving into essence. But Linden didn't feel ashamed. He was filled with relief. They had made it out alive. He was doubly grateful he had thought to hide Orthos and Little Blue. A glancing blow from that battle would have killed them. He would have been worried about their safety, even if they were only exposed to the pressure from Tiberian's remnant.
"Vermin!" Dross cried. "He flees from us like a coward, little knowing that we may bide our time and seek revenge!"
Yeren shot him a strange look, suggesting she'd heard him. "Dross?" Linden asked aloud.
"It is I, the mighty Dross. I have shed my weak former self, emerging from that chrysalis as a spirit with no rival."
Aethon groaned and sat down. "Oh, no. Dross, what happened? Why did you change?" Dross spun out into the real world, and now he wore a tiny, spiked black crown on his head.
"I needed to reach beyond myself, for greater power, but I was pathetic and small, so I became a spirit of true power."
Dross's boneless arms curled into fists and shook at the sky. A knot formed in Linden's stomach. If Dross had been forced to his limit and decided to change himself, he may have done irreparable damage to his own structure.
"So, this is what true power sounds like, is it?"
Yeren asked. She sounded weary, but amused, like this was one of Dross's usual jokes. Aethon traded looks with Linden. He understood.
"Every word I speak is the word of supreme dominance. Have you ever heard of a spirit that could converse with the dread labyrinth itself?"
Linden gingerly extended his perception into the point of his spirit that anchored his connection to Dross. Sure enough, the structure of Dross's spirit was twisted differently. Dross had bent himself into a new shape, and his spirit, body, and mind were one.
"Pardon, Dross, but I'm afraid your new form might be too intimidating for me. Could you change back?"
Linden tried to stifle his own dread and hope so that Dross didn't feel them. Dross eyed him coldly.
"Evolution, once made, cannot be reversed, and why would I wish to return to inferiority?"
Linden sank to the ground. Yeren grabbed him and looked into his eyes.
"Is he?"
She didn't finish the question. Linden shook his head, and she crushed him in an embrace.
"It's not him," Linden whispered. "And even if I were twice the Soulsmith, I don't know if I could do anything about it."
The longer the changes lasted, the more they would become the true Dross. He didn't know Dross's exact structure, and even if he did, he wouldn't have the time to change him back.
"Do you remember how to defeat Rhaegon Shen?"
Linden asked Dross silently. At least there may be some upside to this transformation.
"Why would I need such tricks?"
Dross sneered. Linden's heart crumbled further. Aethon pointed to the wall.
"Far be it from me to dangle a flimsy hope before you, but it's possible we may be able to bypass Rhaegon Shen and still accomplish something down here."
Linden raised his head and looked over Yeren's shoulder. The weathered map, lightly scratched into the wall, had been further obliterated by the battle, but he could still make out the X marking the bottom of the labyrinth.
"Osmanthus' soulsmith inheritance," Linden said aloud.
He perked up. With a soulforge and a soulsmith inheritance of this level...
"Could we fix him?"
Linden asked quietly. But of course, the volume of his voice had no bearing on whether Dross could hear him. The dream spirit swelled up to twice his size.
Do not test me, human. I do not need fixed any more than the moon needs polished. How do you fix that which is already perfect beyond your comprehension?
I'm certain it could be used to that effect, Ethan said carefully. But I am concerned about potential changes to your mentality if you inherited his legacy. He was not a kind man. Though not so concerned as I am about Regunsh and getting it first.
Lyndon shivered as he thought of the monarch falling down the shaft straight toward where the inheritance waited. Would he even care about such an inheritance? He was a legendary soulsmith in his own right. Then again, if it was valuable to him, then they were about to face a monarch with the absorbed memories of a weaponsmith who had ascended to become known as the Reaper of Worlds. That did assume that they were going to continue in the labyrinth.
Of course we are, Dross declared. He has thrown the gauntlet, and we are not the sort of cowards who would fail to pick it up.
Pardon, Ethan, but I need to know something first.
Everyone conscious looked to Ethan, even Dross. Ethan seemed to know what Lyndon was going to ask, because he planted his hands on his hips and beamed.
You want to know about my icons? If you don't mind. The icons that almost formed in my fight with Regan Shen.
Yes.
The very icons that, when manifested fully, would have made me into a sage.
Yaren's red eyes narrowed.
Those shoes will get dirty if you keep dragging your feet.
It's very simple. I'm waiting for another icon.
He glanced around and shuddered.
Besides, I don't want to advance here. The circumstances of your advancement can affect your relationship to an icon, and these tunnels are so dirty.
Dross scoffed, but Lyndon was caught by the first part of the statement.
What icon are you waiting for?
The joy icon.
Yaren groaned.
It's real, Ethan said defensively. It's just not very common. To be frank with you, I take any number of icons, just not anything Osmanthus manifested. I don't want to end up as he did.
Famous? Yaren asked. Powerful?
Alone.
That was painful enough to hear, so Lyndon changed the subject. What did he mean about Tiberian's dream? Ethan sighed and ran a hand over his hair.
This is another step toward coming clean with you two, I suppose. Tiberian's dream was to rid the world of the Dread Gods.
Yaren's eyebrows raised, but Lyndon wasn't too surprised. He suspected she wasn't either. The Aurelius crest on the sealed hand implied as much.
We found a method of doing so, and I encouraged him to pursue the cooperation of the other monarchs, Ethan said, with a sigh. He insisted on starting with Regan Shen, against my advice, might I add. You can usually count on monarchs to avoid open conflict, both because there is rarely a definitive winner, and because there are usually several million definitive losers. Regan Shen struck back almost immediately. In the end, Tiberian was not his match.
Ethan began tearing burned strips of his outer robe away as he spoke.
As you are aware, it is not simple to destroy the Dread Gods. No monarch can defeat one individually, and while the monarchs could collectively destroy the Dread Gods together, there is a reason they do not. A reason I am forbidden by oath to mention. But,
he raised a finger and gave a smile,
I am not forbidden from demonstrating it to you. You will find that reason deeper in the labyrinth, unless I miss my guess.
Lyndon looked at the place where the hole in the floor had led straight to the center of the labyrinth.
So is he really going to kill the Dread Gods?
There is only one truth I trust about Regan Shen. He desires weapons. We can't know if he means to kill them and weaponize their bindings, or leash them as forces of destruction under his control.
Ethan's smile faded.
He wants Cradle, all of our world, and he clearly sees the Dread Gods as the way to take it.
Lyndon's eyes moved from one opening in the wall to another. He could bring out the hand again if they were willing to endure the assault of Hungermadra that would ensue. While he felt the weight of every second, he still spent the time to organize his thoughts before he spoke.
I'm going deeper, Lyndon said. I don't want to go alone.
Neither do I, Lyndon. Neither do I.
Yaren stood up and sheathed her sword. Red lines of blood mudra covered her flesh in a crimson web, knitting her together.
Blind me now if I see any reason to stay here, but we've got to move.
cuts me to say it, but we may need to travel light."
Red eyes flicked from Zeal to Mercy. Lyndon knew she was right, but his heart was heavy.
"We need to move fast if we're going to catch up, but I don't want to leave them behind."
"They can't keep up," Ethan said flatly.
Lyndon felt the hunger aura all around him. It filled him with greed, with a desire to move forward, with an ambition that couldn't be satisfied. The inert fingers of his right hand twitched. Even now, the aura gnawed slowly away at his mudra. But this time, the hunger sparked something in him. Anger.
"I don't want to leave them behind. Do you want to leave them behind?"
Yaren shrugged, but there was sadness in her eyes.
"Done a lot of things I didn't want to.
I say the time for that is over."
With great effort, Lyndon poured mudra into his broken right arm. The hunger mudra creaked, and bits of it snapped off, and spiritual pain ran through his channels. But he clenched his fist.
"If we can't use our power for this, why have it?"
He looked from Ethan to Yaren, and he could feel a fire in his eyes even with no black flame.
"I don't want to win by giving something up. I want it all. I want all of it."
The fury of the void icon faded, and he coughed a little in embarrassment.
"If you're willing, of course."
Yaren leaned into him, and her hand snaked up his chest and over one shoulder.
"Ought to be grateful you don't talk like that more often," she murmured.
Ethan was blinking back tears, which caught Lyndon off guard.
"What?"
Ethan cleared his throat.
"What should we do, Lyndon?"
"I've been sensing something in the labyrinth," Lyndon said. "It feels like echoes of other sacred artists, and I suspect it's a phenomenon of hunger aura."
A look passed over Ethan's eyes that Lyndon couldn't identify, but the Archlord nodded.
"I know what you mean."
"Can you lead us there?"
"If our captor cooperates."
Ethan powerlessly kicked the wall.
"If I'm not mistaken, that would be a great place to train. If the three of us can't help Mercy at least advance, then we have no right to all our titles. I suspect we could learn something as well."
"And if it ends up to be nothing?"
"Then we drag as much power out of ourselves as we can before we run out of time," Lyndon said.
"Then we move." Ethan nodded, and a delighted twinkle returned to his eye.
"I'm just happy to be part of the team."
Lyndon had also once dreamed about fighting side by side with other sacred artists as an equal, but he wasn't about to mention that now.
"Then let's go," Lyndon said.
He moved to pick up Zeal, but Yaren was still holding on to him.
2.5 seconds, she said into his outer robe.
Then she reached up, red eyes blazing, and dragged his head down for a kiss. She released him, and he took a breath.
2.5 more, she said,
and kissed him again. When she finally released him and picked up Mercy, he had to catch his breath. He very carefully did not look at Ethan. Chapter 17. Mercy woke up coughing with a taste of pine sap in her mouth.
"Sorry," Yaren muttered. "Not aiming to drown you."
Yaren tossed aside a bottle that Mercy was certain had held a healing elixir only seconds before. Before the bottle could shatter on the floor, Lyndon caught it with his hand of flesh and tucked it away into his coat. His right hand hung limp and broken at his side, which caught Mercy with a rush of memory. She looked frantically around, and aside from Zeal looking burned, they were all healthy and alive. They were all ragged and beaten, but she let out a heavy breath of relief. She shivered when she considered how close they had all come to death. If Raegon Shen hadn't been so drained of his power, he would have eaten them alive, and if he wasn't notorious for playing with his prey, Akura Malus would never have let them live. They would have died for the sin of standing in a monarch's way. At the thought, she realized they were in a totally different room of the labyrinth. It was a long, narrow oval with a trench at the bottom, only wide enough for one person. Mercy was looking down on it from a slope above, the entire room funneled into the trench.
"Where are we?"
she asked. Yeren crouched next to her. She wore an expectant smile, and her red eyes glowed. She looked like Uncle Fury when he had an idea that he would have described as really fun. Mercy had a premonition of disaster. "Training," Yeren said, with relish. Linden gave Mercy a look of concern. "Are you feeling all right? The construct was stable, but we had to accelerate your healing."
"Better than new,"
Mercy said happily, though that wasn't exactly true. Her Madra reserves were still low, and her channels were strained from the destruction of her bloodline armor, but her body was safe. She remembered Linden covering for her, twice, no less, and wasn't sure whether her gratitude outweighed her embarrassment. On the one hand, he had saved her. On the other hand, he had had to save her. She was dragging them down. Ethan leaned around Linden, giving Mercy that smile that suggested he could read minds.
"Rhaegon Shen is on his way to the bottom of the labyrinth, where we suspect he intends to use the Dread Gods to kill the remaining monarchs. We're going after him."
Mercy's breath quickened as she calculated. Could he do it? Of course he could. He had to have been planning this for months, and it matched up with what Fury and her mother had already suspected him of doing. Did her mother know what he was up to? If not, could Mercy bring her some kind of proof? Only another monarch could stop Rhaegon Shen. She was certain of that after facing off against him herself. Then the impact of Aethon's words fully penetrated the exhaustion of her recovery.
"You're going after him?" "We're going after him," Yeren corrected.
She circled her pointer finger around the group.
"All of us."
Zeal gave Mercy a dead fish look of exasperation.
"I had the same reaction."
"But you've seen... I can't..."
It was surprisingly hard for Mercy to admit that she couldn't match up to someone, even when it was patently obvious. She hadn't thought of herself as a prideful person, but here she was. Linden crouched in front of her.
"We think that, with our help, you can."
Mercy searched his eyes and found rock-solid confidence in her. It was both flattering and very intimidating. Could she live up to that?
"You will be as clay in a master's hands," Ethan said, clawing at the sky. "We will mold you into a weapon that..."
Linden raised his hand and Ethan cut off. Mercy was surprised the Archlord had allowed himself to be interrupted by his student, but he looked oddly pleased.
"What do you think, Yeren?" Linden asked.
Yeren snorted.
"If she's kept up with us this far, she's going all the way."
Then she gave Mercy a wink. Mercy's eyes filled with tears, and she threw an arm around Linden and Yeren. It was hard to speak around tears, but she mumbled something about her thanks and how she wouldn't let them down. The words were incomprehensible, even to her, but her feelings poured out of her mouth. Ethan popped up with a grin.
"You know, I can't help but notice that we're wasting..."
Mercy grabbed him and pulled him into the hug, too.
"Oh, this is nice."
It was Linden who finally pushed back, straightening his outer robe.
"Apologies, but we actually are limited on time. The sooner, the better. And I think we have this technique figured out, but it takes me and Dross working together."
Dross spun out, still wearing his tiny black crown. He gave the trench a glare.
"For now, but soon I will have my full power restored, and then I will operate greater devices than this."
"Yes," Linden said. "Of course."
Mercy wiped her face with her sleeve, trying to stop sniffling long enough to focus.
"All right, what's the technique?"
"It's a hunger ruler technique."
Linden looked over the room with admiration.
"I never thought it was possible until Dross and I found this room in the labyrinth, but it brings out... I suppose they're echoes or forged imitations of people the labyrinth has fed on."
"Demonstration!"
Ethan cried, and Linden didn't need any more encouragement. He eagerly placed his hand against a script panel on one side of the trench. Mercy assumed he would use his pure Madra to activate the technique, since his hunger arm was broken, but she sensed no Madra from him at all. She supposed he was using his authority as a sage, and she felt as uncomfortable as she always did. Sages were always old, even when they didn't look like it. Yeren noticed her discomfort and asked about it, but it was hard to explain.
It's nothing big, but sages are always old, at least on the inside. A sage my age is just
wrong. It's like he's a young man with an old head, you know?
Mercy had tried to control the air with her soul fire to stop Lyndon from hearing their conversation, but the aura was so thin that she was afraid he'd overheard, especially when he looked depressed out of nowhere. She desperately wanted to apologize, but what if he hadn't heard her? Then she'd have to explain. Yaren was giving her an odd look.
Huh. Used to say the same thing. What? Well, a baby's head on a man's body, she said, making no effort to keep her voice down. So not the same, the complete mirror opposite. Been a long time.
She was speaking fondly, but Lyndon was slumped against the panel, and he looked like he was about to collapse in shame and depression.
I'm so sorry, Mercy called.
Lyndon waved it away. Yaren winced.
Oops. Should pay off that debt later.
Finally, Lyndon caught the unfamiliar technique, and Mercy saw the disgusting white hunger aura begin to swirl. It took on a shape in the center, made all of shades of white and gray, until it looked like a person leached of color. A familiar person. A very familiar person. Mercy's breath stopped as she saw the hair pulled back into a ponytail with strands of sticky shadow madra. The familiar build, the stance, the expression, the bow made all of liquid black threads woven together with a dragon's head that hissed. She was sure the woman's bright eyes were actually purple. As the image had started to form, Mercy had at first wondered if this was herself, but every detail that settled proved that wrong. This was her mother, centuries ago. She looked to be Mercy's age.
We scoured the memory of this place, and we found that it had fed upon your mother, Dross said triumphantly. This is a triumph of great effort and skill.
The labyrinth,
Mercy asked.
What you feed on becomes a part of you, Lyndon said. The energy your mother gave the labyrinth is gone. It was consumed long ago, but the memory of her remains. It's powerless, but we should be able to learn from it.
I never knew she came here.
This was a startling revelation. Mercy knew, of course, that she didn't know everything about her mother. It would take her 100 years to read all the stories of Akura Malice, and it wasn't as though Malice was very forthcoming about her past. But she knew Mercy had been here, around Sacred Valley, and she had never said anything. She had even warned Mercy away. Why? Lyndon pulled open a nearby box, which he must have removed from a void key earlier, and aura gushed out. Instantly, hunger aura swarmed over the natural treasures, and Mercy could sense some of the ghoulish spirits coming nearer. They would be crawling through the floor now. He began spreading natural treasures around the room, quickly increasing the power of the ambient aura. Mercy realized what they were trying to do, and she braced herself on Sue.
Do you really think we have time for this? Doesn't take more than a breath,
Yaren said. She patted Mercy on the shoulder.
Might sting, though.
Ethan had taken his own handful of natural treasures, and he called out from the other end of the room.
You have 4 people here who have all successfully completed their Overlord revelation, and you have your own mother to learn from. How could you have a better environment?
Mercy had grown up with near-constant access to people who had advanced past Overlord and in one of the richest inhabitable aura locations in the world. If it was that easy, everyone would have done it. But she still found herself somehow believing it was possible here, now. Why not? She was a peak underlady, and she was even acclimated to Overlord-level Madra and Soulfire, thanks to her book. Now that they'd prepared the environment, the only thing missing was her own revelation. With a deep breath, Mercy slid down the slope and into the trench, facing the black and white image of her mother. Malice spotted Mercy, and Mercy's heart caught. Malice pulled her own bow, identical to Mercy's, back, and forged an arrow on it. Mercy did the same. As they faced one another, Dream Aura drifted over from one of the natural treasures. It twisted and reacted to the Hunger Madra, guided by this place. And Mercy felt something, a taste of her mother's memories. Malice was down here, in the labyrinth, because no one had fully explored it before. This was going to be fuel for her rise to monarch, and she would not allow anyone to get in her way. Both Malice and Mercy released their arrows. Mercy's passed through Malice as though the woman was made of mist, then embedded itself in the wall at the end of the trench. malices struck mercy and dissipated. Even that image called up another instinctive half-memory. Malice was more of an archer than Mercy was. Not just a better archer, more of one. Another memory surfaced, still not Mercy's, but one she'd seen before in a dream tablet she'd won from the Uncrowned King tournament. Larian, the famous archer of the Eight-Man Empire, demonstrated her form as she drew back her bow. Her voice had explained what she was doing.
A launcher construct is by far more efficient than a stick with an elastic string. So why do sacred artists use bows?
She released an arrow, and it streaked through the air, detonating a mountain-sized tree in the distance. The explosion from the arrow filled the sky with dust and debris.
A woman with a bow taps into the power of all who have used bows, of what it means to wield a bow, she continued. You are not just an archer. You are a fragment of the archer, the single template of all archery. The bow is one of the deepest symbols of all.
There was a trace of that concept in her mother's archery. The bow icon, the archer, whatever you wanted to call it. Mercy had meditated on this concept before. She had even asked her mother to demonstrate and viewed the dream tablets that she could handle. But somehow, watching it here and now, a version of her mother who hadn't perfected her connection to an icon yet, caused realization to slide into place. And slowly, subconsciously, Mercy began to adjust her stance in ways she couldn't even name. Zeal looked down on the trench.
We don't have time for this.
In fact, we do, Lathan said casually. Subject One has closed the way forward for the moment, but he has to fight the nature of the labyrinth to hold it. We must wait for his grip to relax, so we might as well put the time to good use.
You don't seem worried about the lost time.
Do you think worrying would help? Athan nodded to Mercy. Besides, if we walk out of here with another young overlady, I will consider that a substantial gain.
This doesn't look like an overlord meditation, he muttered.
An arrow slammed into the wall, and this one caused the room to shake. Athan was leaning on the wall over him.
Even if she doesn't technically advance, this could be a more valuable breakthrough. After all, we're not sages, are we?
Don't blow smoke in my eyes.
If Athan had the resources to perform the pure storm baptism and was insightful enough to give a monarch advice while still an underlord, he wouldn't be stuck as a mere archlord. Meanwhile, Zeal was happy just having a healthy body and spirit.
Am I? He wondered.
It wasn't that long ago since he had felt something else as he faced down the Titan. Some part of him still wanted more. There were dream artists who performed mental therapy. He should find one of them. Too bad he didn't have any Lord revelations left. He could have used a nice, cleansing, personal revelation. Yeren and Linden were moving around the room, crushing hunger spirits with minimal madra expenditure. This was known as one of the deadliest locations in the world where even lords could be devoured, and they were treating it like a game, squashing bugs.
It's too bad you don't want to improve anymore, Athan said.
He buffed fingernails against the front of his robes, which would have been more elegant if he wasn't still covered in marks from his fight earlier.
Yeah, too bad.
We'd love to have you along.
That irritated Zeal into responding, which itself irritated him further. Not long ago, nothing would have bothered him.
Why do you want me? We're not friends. There's no connection between us. Are you trying to get me in your debt? What is this?
Oh, did Linden not tell you?
Zeal remembered the uncomfortably intense stare of the Void Sage and had to focus on not shivering.
I will admit I underestimated you all. You're freaks, and I say that with true admiration. I salute you. But you're all burning with ambition, and that fire went out of me years ago.
Athan nodded along with every word.
It did, and it left behind a pile of ashes. But I can't help but look at those ashes and think, what a blaze that must have been.
In spite of himself, Zeal rested a hand on the head of his hammer. He remembered commissioning this hammer. He had earned the metal himself, designed it, and worked closely with the soulsmith. He had imagined all the grand deeds he would perform with the hammer. That hammer had taken the lives of many Dreadgod cultists. He remembered the fury that had filled him, the grief
back when it was an empowering force instead of a blanket smothering him.
It's too late for me anyway,
Zeal muttered, and even he didn't know where the words were coming from.
I don't have what it takes to become a sage.
How would you know? Ethan shot back. What are you, some kind of sage?
Zeal glared at him.
Besides, if you can reach peak Archlord, you know what it takes to become a herald. Brute force.
Brute force as in enough raw resources to choke a monarch, but you left out the part where you need such a thorough understanding of your own spirit that you and your remnant can work together.
Zeal gave Ethan a smug look.
Don't think that just because I'm young I haven't done my research.
Just as many sacred artists remained stuck at different stages in the Lord realm because they didn't understand how to pass their revelations, many Archlords remained stuck because they had no one to teach them how to reach Herald. Often, by the time they did find someone to tell them the truth, their spirits were twisted against them, sometimes because of injury or broken oaths, and sometimes because their spirits hated them. Zeal would fall into that last category, he was certain. Even if his soul was stable enough after the pure storm baptism to advance its level of existence, his remnant wouldn't work with him, he was certain. He wouldn't work with himself, and that was the same thing.
You think I underestimated you? Ethan asked curiously. Quite the opposite. I think I'm estimating you much more highly than you are.
He waved a hand.
But forget it then. I can't drag you up a hill toward a glorious future. Instead, why don't you help me? There are some young people here who could use our worldly guidance.
Zeal gave a humorless laugh.
What am I supposed to teach an overlord sage or history's first overlord herald?
I always find it arrogant to assume we know everything that has happened in history, but let's leave that aside. Neither of them are archlords, and neither of them have ever led a sect before. I believe your input could be very valuable to them.
Zeal grumbled inwardly about it, but he was curious to see what these young people could do with such a start. They had a fire for advancement that burned even brighter than his once had. How far could that take them, if it wasn't snuffed out?
He had to admit, he did want to see it.
The hunger aura was steadily eating away at the natural treasures Linden had placed all around the room, and the focus of the labyrinth itself was on Linden. The hunger mudra attacks were growing more frequent. While Zeal and Ethan were talking on the other side of the room, he and Yaren kept the hunger mudra under control and watched Mercy.
You think she's creeping up on Overlord?
Yaren asked.
I think so,
Linden said, watching Mercy battle the echo of her mother. They had closed to melee combat now, which was strange to watch, as neither could truly touch the other. But this was something like a meditative state.
I felt it myself, Linden continued.
You're working with the memories they left behind as much as anything, but it will respond to what you do, unlike a dream tablet. This should help her work out her own condition. Yaren fidgeted, pulling on her lock of red hair. Finally, she asked,
You catch a glimpse of my master in there.
Apologies, Linden said, in true regret. I searched, but there were just too many. But I suspect he is there if we can find him.
No, wipe it clean. Shouldn't have asked.
Below them, Mercy had frozen. The image of her mother continued attacking, but she looked as though she'd seen something in the distance. The cycling of her mudra reached a crescendo, and the aura in the room swirled around her.
I am,
she began.
Not my mother.
The aura didn't react. Mercy's face fell.
I was sure that was it.
A ghostly arrow passed through her body. Yaren hopped down into the trench between Mercy and her mother, ignoring Malice's attacks.
That was mine, not my master. Wasn't happy about it. I thought I had it.
Mercy scuffed the ground with the butt of her staff.
Never said you didn't.
Yaren leaped over Mercy and landed on her other side, then grabbed the back of Mercy's head and angled her to look at Malice's face.
You're not your mother. Okay. Tell me what's different. I'm not as ruthless as she is,
Mercy said, as though admitting something. Malice sneered at her and loosed another arrow.
Cut deeper,
Yaren said.
I don't have the same drive. She's willing to do whatever she has to. You know, once she...
Yeren interrupted.
Deeper. Is this what worked for you? I don't...
Yeren shook her.
You talking to me or you looking at her?
Mercy slowly quieted and focused on her mother. Linda felt the interaction of dream and hunger aura, and he suspected Yeren was bathed in it too, but she didn't react. The aura trembled, and he rushed over to the panel. The technique was destabilizing, thanks to the imbalance of the aura. He could hold it, but he wouldn't be able to fend off the labyrinth's attacks in the rest of the room. He waved to the two men across the room, but they were still talking. Ethan waved back without looking.
I like people, Mercy said. She's not kind, she's cruel.
The aura from the natural treasures began to tremble.
She isn't just callous, she continued. She likes it when her enemies are afraid of her. Malice is the virtue she's named after. It's the hatred that drives you to be merciless to those who oppose you.
There was a resonance in the aura that even Linden could sense, so Mercy's spirit must be trembling. She was close. Now she was whispering.
I don't want that. I've never wanted that. I want the opposite. I want to be...
She stopped. Then she corrected herself.
She's malice. I am mercy.
Around the room, the natural treasures ignited. Yeren had to release Mercy as the soul fire inside her went up in response. As Mercy advanced, the labyrinth reacted. Linden had expected some kind of reaction from the Hunger Madra, but the ghouls that clawed their way up from the ground were not simple, and they weren't alone. Forged webs shot toward Mercy from every direction. He drove his fist through one of the ghouls, his channels filled with pure Madra, but it was harder than he'd expected. It took him two blows to crush the living technique, and then he had to exert real force to pull some webs down. Either the Hunger Madra was stronger here, or this attack was particularly fierce. Ethan and Zeal both were roused, but just like Linden, neither of them were eager to use more of their Madra than they had to. Zeal was swinging his hammer without rings of script around it, and Ethan was just using his scissors. Yeren was fighting the hardest. Mercy's advancement was taking longer than Linden's had, most likely because of the aura imbalance here in the labyrinth, but possibly because of the interference of the Hunger Madra. She was helpless as the attention of the whole room was focused on her. Yeren covered her like a red and black blur, her gold signs and sword flashing. Both had been enforced with Madra, and she slammed into ghouls and webs alike with the force of a herald. Linden couldn't help but worry. They were running low on elixirs, and while Yeren might not need her Madra as much as the rest of them, given the strength of her physical body, she would still be in trouble if she ran out. He could afford to spend more than she could, so he covered Yeren with black flame. The webs burned relatively easily, though he had to focus on his will to pierce some of the larger ghouls. Yeren slowed down, and after not too long, the Book of Eternal Night materialized over Mercy. The divine treasure shone as a thick violet tome, and as Linden watched, it slowly flipped its thick, glassy pages until it rested on the fifth. Then it faded back into Mercy, and she awoke with a gasp, as an overlady. Her clothes and weapons were unharmed, but Linden could feel her spiritual pressure. Unfortunately, the transformation had consumed much of her soul fire, but it would be worth the increase in her strength.
Phew!
Mercy examined her black-gloved hands.
You know, I didn't think it would make much of a difference, since I've used the fifth page so much already, but it feels good.
Yeren looked to her amid a rising tide of white sparks, the essence of all the Hunger Madra she'd destroyed.
Glad you're feeling all fresh and shiny new.
Mercy watched the echo of her mother, which was tracking her with an arrow. She pressed her fists together and saluted the image of Malice. Malice eyed Mercy with disdain, but she lowered her bow. Then she saluted back. Her image vanished, and power stopped flowing through the scripts all around the room. Linden ran his perception through them to make sure nothing had broken, but it seemed like the echo of Malice had cut off the process on her own. He could activate it again, but... Around the room, the entrances blurred. Now there was only one exit from the room. Linden pulled out the silver case that contained the hand of Subject One and eyed the single tunnel. He extended his senses down the hall and sensed nothing, but he prepared to unlock the case. Ethan stopped him. He had an odd look on his face.
Save the effort, I think. I can see where we're going.
Zeal rested against his hammer. And where is that?
Deeper, Ethan said grimly. Subject One couldn't keep us out any longer, so it's drawing us closer.
Lyndon didn't like the sound of that.
Chapter 18. A white snake wrapped around the point of Jai Long's spear, and he shattered the shield of his true gold opponent with one final thrust. Without the shield to stop him, his spear skewered her into the ground. He stood panting and bleeding, one eye gummed shut with blood. His mask was torn and ragged. The two remaining high golds and remaining low gold of the enemy squad cut and ran.
Remnant,
he called, though there was no need. Fingerling sprayed destructive pink light over the slate-gray remnant that started pulling its way out of the enemy true gold. Kelsa was there in a moment, foxfire in each hand, which burned remnants better than it did the living. He had to help out with a strike or two. The remnant had come from a true gold, after all, but they collapsed the remnant to chunks before it could hit them. The allied soulsmiths would be disappointed. They paid a premium for true gold dead matter, and Kelsa was already wrapping some of the intact bits in scripted cloth to preserve it for sale, but Jai Long had concerns about their immediate survival. He signaled his squad to fall back. No losses today. One high gold and two low golds had died and been replaced under his command already. The fighting among the golds wasn't merciless. They were fighting for territory, not extermination, but that didn't mean it was safe, and he wasn't even sure how it was going. Granted, their forces were creeping closer and closer to Mount Samara, through the foothills and lesser mountains between the desolate wilds and Sacred Valley, but the real battle was being fought overhead. Thunder and lightning cracked the sky as underlords clashed in flight. One was a burly, bearded man from the Cloudhammer sect. His weapon and raincloud gold sign gave him away. That was the underlord from the Black Flame Empire. His opponent was probably 20 years his junior and also carried a cloud over his head. The Ghost Blade wore gray robes and a veil over his face, and his gold sign was a hovering spirit of death mantra. He swept a blade of death at the cloud hammer, who responded with a force technique and another explosion. They were hundreds of yards away, but the wind ruffled Jai Long's hair. And that fight was one of 100. Underlords fought, firing techniques of incredible scope with overlords above and between them. Here and there, even archlords. As terrifying as that fact was, it wasn't as bone-chilling as the reality that the real powers of each side hadn't even moved. The occasional technique that a herald or sage sent out shone like sunrise and blotted out spiritual perception all over the battlefield. Those weren't even attacks. They were warnings. The battle was being fought on the ground, and Jai Long wasn't certain anything they did would even matter. He led his squad back to the camp, which was close enough that thunder from distant techniques constantly rolled over everything. He was used to it by now. After a bath and a meal, he returned to his nightly ritual. He had distinguished himself in combat, earning natural treasures for his own personal use. If he advanced to Underlord, not only would his conditions get better, but he might be able to move Jai Chen and Kelsa to a safer position, or at least one more suitable for low golds. As he reached out to the circle of natural treasures around him, he focused on his desire to protect them. It was old and familiar, at least where Jai Chen was concerned, and he was sure that this thread would lead to his Underlord revelation. Lyndon had spoken to Jai Long about advancing to Underlord many times, and often repeated the same phrase, "Follow your fear." Failing his sister was one of the oldest fears Jai Long could remember. He had been one of the talents of his clan from a young age, and when he let down the expectations of his elders, he had been terrified that Jai Chen would be implicated with him. Now he felt that same fear. Would he let her down? Would his lack of ability lead to her death? The soul fire in his spirit didn't shiver. That was to be expected. The aura was thick enough, but after so many failed attempts, he had stopped using the most powerful natural treasures he could. This was hardly the richest environment possible for an Underlord advancement, but surely he would still feel it when the moment came.
He strained to sense any change, pushing his spiritual sense as hard as he had since advancing to Jade. The very day he'd advanced and developed his spiritual perception, he had pushed himself to prove his talent, to show the Jai elders that he was worthy of their attention and respect. He had been so afraid to let them down. The aura around him shivered and triggered his soul fire. His advancement to Underlord had begun. Jai Long was so stunned that he almost forgot to guide the soul fire through his body. That was it? An idle thought? What was the revelation? But he didn't have time to think about it unless he was willing to let the soul fire rush through his body unguided. When he shifted his attention to the colorless flame reforging his flesh and spirit together, he discovered a problem. The soul fire was far too slow. Panic gripped his heart, and he immediately regretted not preparing all the treasures he could. At this rate, he couldn't know how long it would take him to advance. Days? Weeks? He had just been trying to sense the resonance of the aura. He hadn't truly intended to advance. After hundreds, perhaps thousands of tries, who would have thought he would succeed now? The soul fire wasn't painful, but his spirit would be unbalanced until the advancement completed. His madra would be almost unusable. And his squad had to fight in the morning. If he had known, he would have waited for more powerful natural treasures. He controlled the soul fire to focus on his core. Maybe if it finished his spirit first, he could get himself in fighting shape as fast as possible. A messenger found him within 2 hours, bringing congratulations from an underlord and instructions to remain out of the battlefield until the end of his advancement. His squad, meanwhile, would be returning to battle in the morning, without him. Jai Long couldn't go find Jai Chen or Kelsa. Every second he spent doing anything except cycling would extend the time his advancement took to complete. The next morning, his squad left without him. His baptism in soul fire had barely begun.
"This is what you get for leaving us in there for so long," Orthos grumbled. "I ate all your plants."
Little Blue whistled her own indignation. She sat on Orthos's back and crossed her arms, looking away from Linden.
"I ate the pots, too."
"My sincere apologies," Linden said, "but it's very dangerous. I was concerned that you might have been trapped inside."
Little Blue's huff wavered. She glanced down to Orthos.
"We were still worried,"
Orthos grunted. Blue nodded.
"I am sorry, but I'm glad you weren't around for our fight with Raygun Shen."
Orthos and Little Blue glared at him together.
"We were concerned about you," Orthos said. "You could have informed us."
Linden dipped his head and apologized. They should have been able to sense that he was still alive, even from within a separate space, but he should have kept them aware. Yaren strolled back to meet them and sat on her heels next to Orthos.
"Yeah, we fought a monarch. Got whipped like the slowest mule, but we didn't die. So, there's a shiny spot."
They were all sitting around for a while, waiting for another trapped room to die down. While flames of all colors raged in the next room, they sat in the hallway. Aethon paced back and forth, Mercy cycled, and Zeal loudly snored as he slept. Linden filled in Orthos and Little Blue about what had happened since they were locked inside the Dawn Sky Palace. They were a rapt audience, eyes glowing as they listened. When he finished, Orthos thoughtfully chewed on something for a long moment.
"That's not a bad excuse," he allowed.
Little Blue clambered up Linden's shoulder, chiming about how glad she was that everyone had made it out alive. The chimes woke Zeal, who rolled over to squint in the spirit's direction.
"Glad you're happy," he muttered.
"Almost ready,"
Aethon called from the brink of the next room, and everyone began to busy themselves. Linden still hadn't closed the entrance to his void key, so the Dawn Sky Palace hung open. Mercy brightened and ran over as she saw Orthos and Little Blue, but Linden addressed them first.
"If you stay out here with us, I'm afraid I might not be able to open the key again. You might get hurt. Are you willing to risk it?"
Orthos and Blue traded uncertain glances. Little Blue gave a whistle, but it wavered unsteadily.
If you get too weak from the hunger aura, I'll have to send you back, Linden said, as he let the void key vanish. He didn't add that the same remained true for the rest of them. Soulfire now burned merrily in all of them. Zeal, Mercy, and Yeren had used up the last of the natural treasures Linden had brought along, at least the ones that he could successfully balance out to create Soulfire. Everyone's cores were full too, even Linden's, but they were completely out of elixirs. The only compatible scales they had left were Pure or Black Flame. Linden and Athan hadn't needed to refill their Madra as much as the others, but at the same time, when they did need to recover, it took them more to fill up their cores. They also couldn't restore Pure Madra using Aura, but that disadvantage was shared by everyone down here. Every second, the Hunger Aura nibbled away at their power. Anything that they spent now, and any energy consumed by hunger techniques, would be gone for good. Linden and Athan were the only ones with scales left. When the traps cleared, they dashed through and found a hall with a mark that seized Linden's attention. It was the four-part symbol that had marked the ancestor's tomb from the outside, the mark of the dread gods. They passed beneath it and into a room that seemed to be nothing but row upon row of circular transparent tanks. They weren't made from glass, though, but from some kind of loose fabric like transparent skin. These tanks, or sacks, or whatever they were, had long been empty. Linden suspected from the scripts and tubes around them that they would usually be filled with liquid, and at that point the skins would be taut. But this machinery hadn't been operational for centuries. Dead tanks spread ahead of them in rows, but Linden studied them in glimpses as he ran past. Dross was responsible for noticing and remembering more details.
These were nothing compared to the specimen tanks in Ghostwater. So outdated. We glorify the past too much, and we fail to notice the strides we've made in more modern times.
Linden tuned Dross out. They were rushing through the labyrinth as quickly as they could, but all of them slowed when they reached the end of the room. Four tanks had been removed from the last row, elevated onto a higher platform and surrounded by tools. Linden didn't need to identify the scripts on the scopes, gauges, and marked sticks to know that these were all measuring tools. And he had a good guess at what was special about these tanks. One had been stained red, one blue-gold, one a heavy yellow, and one purple and white. Linden slowed to examine some partial notes that remained on the nearby tables, but he knew what these had to be. The tanks where the dread gods were born. A quick glance through the notes led him to a quick hypothesis. He ran it by Dross, who agreed.
Yes, these were most likely unremarkable dread beasts when they were born. Clearly, this was the facility in which creatures were infused with hunger and then had their growth accelerated. Once the dread gods grew beyond their peers, their birthplace was removed and examined more closely.
Linden had kept his perception extended for dream tablets or guide constructs that Dross could absorb to understand more of the research, but he found nothing. Yeren stood before the blood-colored tank, looking disgusted.
Feels like rubbing mud in your face.
The sensation the four tanks gave off was nauseating, and to Linden's intrigue, it was more than spiritual. They radiated not just the power of Madra and Aura, but an ancient authority that he recognized. Athan danced closer, then rapped his knuckles on the solid base of one of the tanks.
It's not the whole tank, I'd say.
At Athan's knocking, a tray slid open in the tank's base. Within was a... Linden didn't know what to call it. It looked like a bone, twisted into a shape that resembled a ring. It contained a smooth ruby that had once given off a powerful blood aura, but instead of strengthening over time, it had emanated its power with nothing to replenish it. Now the once strong natural treasure only gave off a tiny radiance of red aura. But it felt heavy to Linden. He was reminded of the pearl necklace and the other items he'd taken from Osriel's room, but this was in a higher realm entirely. To his senses, it felt as if the weight of this bone ring could warp the world. He didn't want to touch it. As Yeren had said, this gave off the disgusting impression of the bleeding phoenix, but he wasn't going to leave a treasure like this behind. Zeal and Mercy had pried open the purple and white
tank belonging to the Silent King, and the treasure they recovered resembled a twisted thigh bone with an amethyst randomly fused into it. It gave off a weak wisp of dream aura, but it carried a powerful hunger to dominate.
"A noble artifact," Dross said. "I will accept it as tribute."
Linden was briefly excited at the idea. If he could imbue this level of significance into Dross, how much stronger could the spirit get? But he discarded the idea immediately. It would only take him further away from his goal of getting the real Dross back, and it wasn't as though such power could be as easily transferred as aura. Though that thought brought him inevitably to the Soul Forge. Ethan handed the device to him, and Linden opened the portal to the Soul Forge right in front of the tanks. Space groaned as the portal opened, and only a breath later, Linden forced his personal void key open. The sound that accompanied the portal's sluggish opening was concerning. He was certain that his key wouldn't last much longer. But this was worth it, even if the key broke. He walked out with the broken fragments of Regan Shen's death-aspected trident, three broken hammers that he'd scavenged, one of his bundles of soul-smithing tools, and the box containing the Tomb Hydra's binding.
"I look forward to seeing if the Soul Forge lives up to its reputation," Linden said, hiding his excitement.
Ortho spoke from Yeren's shoulder.
"How long until the exit opens?"
"Should have a few minutes," Ethan called back.
Linden had reached for the case containing Subject One's hand, but he stopped when Ethan spoke.
"Are you sure?" "If I weren't, I would still say this is a risk worth taking. Or would you rather confront Regan Shen again with the same weapons we used last time?"
Without another word, Linden headed into the starry world of the Soul Forge. He strode out onto the platform, and the others filed in after him. The blue fire blazed in the altar at the center of the stones, and Linden sensed that he shouldn't have to fuel it for at least one project. Without consulting with Ethan, he threw the broken hammers onto the center of the altar. Immediately, the physical wood of the broken hammers' hilts caught fire. Linden controlled the fire aura to smother the flame, but he shot a startled look at Ethan. The Archlord gave him a shooing motion.
"It's more about the idea of the hammer than the physical form. Natural part of the process."
If Linden wanted to complete a project like repairing and empowering a weapon of Regan Shen's, he wanted every advantage he could. And Ethan and Osriel had both emphasized the use of a hammer, so he'd start using one. Or at least repairing the ones he had.
"Focus as I guide you," Dross said arrogantly. "I will not steer you wrong."
Linden didn't fully trust Dross's new personality, but he certainly had Osriel's dream tablets. He focused on the power on the altar, letting Dross feed the memories of other soulsmiths into the back of his mind. Linden imagined a hammer in his mind. Not its form, but its purpose. He needed a tool to deliver his will, to shape the material in front of him. One that wouldn't lose out to Regan Shen's weapons, and wouldn't deform in his hands. His will started unopposed, then he felt stiff opposition, like he had suddenly tried to lift a heavy weight. The flames surrounding the broken hammers turned blue, and the material began to rise slowly into the air. Linden fixed his concentration, pushing his willpower into the project, as he had when he'd torn open space. He could feel the broken hammers. They had once been used to craft masterpieces. He treated that as though it were a new aspect of Madra, weaving it into his ultimate design. The blue light started to congeal into the vague outline of a hammer. This wasn't enough, and Linden felt instinctively what he had to do next. Part of that was the intuition he'd inherited from the memories of other soulsmiths, but part was his own experience. He needed to invest power of his own into this project. Linden poured pure Madra into the hammer, visualizing as he did the purpose of pure Madra in soulsmithing, its universal compatibility, and its ability to purify. But before the hammer congealed around the pure Madra, he stopped, and he switched his cores. He wanted this hammer to represent his power at its most complete state, so he poured black flame into the hammer. Black flame added deadly force and destructive intention to weapons, and it too could be used to burn away materials and impurities. When he had added an equal amount of black flame, he stopped pouring in Madra and began using his will to guide the forces together. He intended to blend them, but Dross stopped him.
Stop, you fool! Can't you see they've achieved a balance already?
At the heart of the blue outline, that only vaguely resembled a hammer, two powers swirled. One bright and blue-white, and another darkness outlined in red. They swam around one another like twin fish, and they did indeed feel perfectly in balance. That was where Lyndon's experience failed him. His will trembled as he held the hammer half-manifested.
"What do I do now?" Lyndon asked.
He vaguely assumed it had something to do with soul fire. Just when he was prepared to brute force it, Ethan leaned forward.
"Now, bring it forth. It isn't real enough yet, like a jade remnant that has just manifested. Pull it out until it becomes reality."
Lyndon's voice was strained with the effort of keeping the hammer half-existing.
"What about soul fire?"
"What do you think that is?"
Ethan pointed down to the blue flame in the center of the altar. Aside from the fact that they were both in the form of fire, the flame in this altar had very little resemblance to soul fire, especially since Archlord soul fire was its highest level, and that looked like quicksilver. Even Ghostwater had been formed with Archlord soul fire, not this blue kind. But Lyndon's will was at its limit, so he couldn't wait to debate. He pushed one more time, shoving the hammer into reality. As he did, he had one strange thought. He was pulling something into existence and out of nothingness. That resonated with the void icon, but he wasn't sure exactly how yet. It was worth examining later. He got a brief glimpse of a black hammer with a double-sided head, one side blue and one red. Then the azure soul fire consumed it, hiding it for a moment. When the flame passed, he could see his hammer. Just sitting on the dark metal of the altar, it emanated a heavy pressure. Its will thrummed against his own, and he could feel its desire to create, hanging in the air like a musical note. It was made of a black metal he couldn't quite identify, but that he recognized from the heads of the hammers he'd used to make it. The handle was rough enough that his hand wouldn't slip, and the two halves of the head were very different. The black flame half shone red and gave off a sharp, even savage impression. The pure half was smooth, with round edges, and it emanated a soothing air. But when he picked it up, the weight was perfectly balanced. Red and blue lines trailed in the air behind it as he turned to show it to everyone.
"That was strange," Lyndon said.
It had felt as much like difficult manual labor as an effort of creation. Without Dross guiding him, he would have needed to fail many times to create such a product, and without the Soul Forge, the result would have been much lower.
"What are you going to name it?"
Zeal asked. Yeren nodded.
"Needs a name."
Everyone had crowded into the Soul Forge's platform, and Lyndon began to wonder if the presence of so many people here would overburden the pocket world.
"Names are said to have an effect on an object's purpose," Ethan said.
Lyndon could tell that they were heading into a situation in which everyone shouted out their suggestions for a name, so he turned to Dross instead. That conversation, at least, could be held at the speed of thought.
"What do you think?"
"Worldbreaker, father of weapons, iron of the netherworld, midnight, cursed genesis of the destroyer."
"I don't mind genesis," Lyndon thought. Dross spat at him.
"Genesis,"
Lyndon said firmly, to cut off the discussion beginning around him. Zeal shrugged.
"Eh.
Sure,"
Ethan said.
"Makes things. There's sense to it, and it's not all flowered up."
Yeren nodded.
"I think it needs to be longer,"
Mercy said, running a hand down Eclipse, ancient bow of the Soul Seeker. Little Blue waved her hands in the air and cheered the new hammer. Orthos blew smoke. "Very good," Lyndon said, having gotten enough consensus. He hadn't been overly concerned about making the hammer. The materials he'd used weren't too valuable, and he wouldn't be losing much even if he failed. But now the blue soul fire inside the Soul Forge had died down noticeably, and it needed fuel. And the components? Well, he'd gotten them for free, and as such wouldn't really be losing out if the soulsmithing created a useless product. He was still afraid to mess up. Onto the altar went the two broken halves of Regan Shen's death trident and the beating, throbbing, heart-shaped binding from the tomb hydra.
The death mudra immediately resonated between the two of them, and some death mudra strings, dead matter that were still attached to the heart, began to weave around the trident.
"Better hurry up," Ethan observed. "Looks like it's trying to finish itself."
Linden gripped the bone ring set with the ruby, the object that had once given birth to the bleeding phoenix. He felt its weight on the world and looked back to Ethan.
"Are we sure we want to—"
Ethan slapped his hand, knocking the twisted ring into the soul forge. The circle of bone flew into the flames. Instantly, the blue fire roared. It swelled to fill the entire interior of the altar to the point that flames licked out around Linden's knees. He wondered whether the altar could handle it. The invisible energy on the surface of the altar grew powerful, and the trident levitated into the air, carrying the death binding with it. Linden wasn't sure whether it was an effect of the soul forge or the materials, but he could sense the hunger aspect of the binding much more clearly than he had before. He pushed only a little, and the physical form of both faded. They didn't burn away to blue light like the hammers had. This time, they seemed to fade until they covered one another, like one piece of paper layered on another. This time, Linden could feel an easy resonance with the void icon. There was hunger in the binding, and a hunger in the trident, too. A hunger to destroy the enemy, to bring death. Linden spun Genesis in one hand, and he didn't need anyone to tell him to use the red side. Black flame focused his will as he slammed it down on the two ghostly images.
"You bring destruction," Linden thought. The heart squeezed halfway into the trident, and the weapon's physical metal began to shift. The two halves slid closer together. "You bring ruin."
The metal came together, and the binding disappeared into the weapon. Now loose strands of death mudra flailed around, and even the steel of the trident glowed an eerie spectral green. But Linden wasn't watching its physical shell. He could feel the essence of the weapon in the void icon. Having used the soul forge once before, he could more clearly feel how this process was similar to the soulsmithing he'd always known. Normally, he balanced different aspects of mudra with his own, while making sure to manually mold its physical shape. Now he was holding the clashing wills in the weapon, molding and steering them into one purpose.
"You bring death," Linden said.
Dross cackled in his head. The hammer came down again, and this time Linden saw and felt a clash of red against green, fire against death. The trident shone, and blue soul fire erupted upward in a roar. It surrounded the weapon so that he couldn't see it, and instead of passing over it, it twisted and disappeared as though it had been inhaled into the trident. An entirely new weapon hung in the air, a spear. Its shaft was dark with a green tint to it, and the steel of its blade was a death green chrome. Spectral green sparks came off the weapon here and there as though it were still hot. And its presence. In Linden's senses, it pushed against the world so that the air seemed to bend around the spear. It pushed against the spirits of everyone present, eager to be used. Even its spiritual might wasn't at all inferior to the attack of the sword Rigon Shen had used to crack space.
"I don't know that you could quite call it a monarch weapon," Ethan said. "But a monarch wouldn't be ashamed to use it."
Linden wasn't at all embarrassed by the evaluation. He agreed. This could be considered a herald weapon with added significance. Perhaps one day it would evolve into a monarch weapon if someone used it to accomplish great deeds, but even at the moment, he would pit it against almost any other weapon he'd ever encountered. He sent a glance at Mercy's bow, Sue, which was currently in its staff form. Without knowing exactly what the spear's binding did, he couldn't be certain how it stacked up, but in terms of its overwhelming aura, the spear definitely won. Mercy was looking at the hovering weapon in excitement.
"Name!"
"We don't have time,"
Linden said, but the others overrode him.
"Linden already had a turn," Ethan shouted. "Who's next?"
After a moment of deliberation, Linden was left with Midnight, Cursed Spear of the Destroyer. Dross and Mercy had combined forces and dominated the discussion. He was almost afraid to grab the weapon, even as its creator. If his hunger arm was functional, he would have had more faith in that, but he ended up gingerly retrieving the spear. Its will to destroy was almost a voice in his mind, and he found himself wishing he could keep it in his void key. But he wouldn't risk opening the key again in the labyrinth unless he had to.
"Good timing," Ethan said, looking out of the portal. "It seems we're due for another shuffle."
Sure enough, as Linden closed the soul forge and slipped its key around his neck, they saw the walls of the labyrinth blurring. The lights flickered as the entrances changed. New doorways opened up all around the room, but one caught everyone's attention in the first moment. Instead of a gaping cave mouth onto a hallway of stone, this one was a small wooden door leading off of the platform with the Dreadgod tanks. It simply hadn't been there before. And instead of a symbol over it, there was a handprint. It was thin and skeletal, sunk into the stone, and it had stained the rock white. Ethan strode forward.
"Well, this seems like the obvious choice, doesn't it?"
He threw open the door. It was a narrow closet, but there was only one object inside. A tank, just like those that had once given birth to the first generation of Dreadbeasts. But none of them wondered why it had been separated from the others. This one was corrupted and half-melted, turned gray-white. It gave off waves of hunger aura, and a level of significance that at least matched the other Dreadgod pods. The birthplace of Subject One. Linden could sense the void icon clearly here, and he longed to stay in the room and meditate on the nature of his icon. Instead, he rapped to open up the drawer. This time, instead of a twisted bone, there was dust, fine gray sand, or perhaps fine ash. As with the others, the power had been leached out of this natural treasure long ago. Linden swept it into a bag that came with his soulsmithing supplies, afraid to miss even a grain. As he did, he opened himself up to the void icon. There were reflections on the concept of nothingness everywhere. What was hunger if not a desire to devour, a will to allow this stranger in and kill me, borrow my powers, start the chain of events that would finally end it all? Linden staggered back. The sudden intrusion of thoughts that weren't his own had disrupted his concentration.
"Did you hear that?" Linden asked.
"Clear, firm resolve. You should learn from him."
"That was..."
"Subject One, I'm sure. The thought clearly came from below us, which you would notice if you had paid attention. Let's see if we can hear more."
Linden reached out again, and the sensation was instant.
He waits in the darkness. He had waited for time beyond counting, hungry for freedom, for power, for everything. He only knew hunger and the connection to the others of his kind that remained on the surface, those who had followed him, the Dreadgods. Finally, a monarch had come to him. Finally. Finally, one of those who had cursed the world had come to end what they had created. Subject One welcomed Rhaegon Shen with open arms. The monarch was close and would be here soon. He would close off the labyrinth from the pursuers so they could not interfere. For the slumbering wraith hungered for all things, even death.
"Out!" Linden shouted.
He tried to shove everyone out the door, but it had already blurred closed. They were surrounded by nothing but featureless stone. Ethan had theorized earlier that the labyrinth couldn't lock them in. It had to move on set paths in certain patterns. Osriel's remaining dream tablet had suggested the same. But now, the labyrinth had broken its own rules to turn against them, and they were trapped.
Chapter 19. "There's no way this can stay locked for long," Linden said, as he scanned the sealed room they were crammed into. If Orthos had been his normal size, they wouldn't have all been able to fit into this room at all. Now they were packed around Subject One's birth pod, and Linden had Zeal's hammer jammed up against his jaw and Yeren's back pushing into his. Orthos and Little Blue had scrambled to the top of his head, and Blue was ringing like a panicked bell. Ethan nudged Mercy's staff away from his face and spoke.
"It's too bad that time is of the essence, because I don't know if the labyrinth can seal us in here for minutes or for days."
Linden, of course, had no idea either, but it was clear to him that the labyrinth had been twisted out of its natural patterns. Not only did it make sense logically, but he could feel it. The labyrinth's controller had twisted space to lock them here, which couldn't last forever. He looked to the wall a few feet away. What does that script do? There was a slight indentation in the wall, which held a script at about head height. Zeal answered him.
It's a spatial transfer script, like the ones on a transport anchor. I'm no sage, so I don't know exactly how it works, but it's written like a one-way trip.
Linden guessed that made sense, and Dross chuckled along with his thoughts.
Yes, they had to ditch their failures somewhere, didn't they? Those inferior beasts who couldn't properly adapt to the energy must have been shipped off to the surface.
At least there's a way out, Mercy said.
Ethan sat on one ledge of the tank.
If I didn't know better, I would think the labyrinth was trying to kick us out.
They were being rejected, and Linden knew it. Subject One had chosen Raygun Shen, so it was blocking their way forward. There was nothing for them to do but retreat.
Or...
Linden tapped the floor with his foot.
It will be difficult, and I can't make any promises, but I think I can break through the floor.
If that doesn't wring your spirit dry, I'll dig through the next floor with my teeth.
Yaren gave him a frown over her shoulder. Zeal sighed and leaned his head back against the wall.
What do you think we're going to do to Raygun Shen if we catch up to him and you're out of power? You think Aurelius is going to smile him to death?
I've done it before. Smoke blew down into Linden's eyes, and he blinked it away.
Very well,
Ortho said solemnly.
I'll do it.
Linden considered very carefully how to refuse without destroying Orthos's feelings. But before he came to a conclusion, Dross laughed out loud.
Ridiculous! What can an Underlord sacred beast do to the stone of the labyrinth? Can you sense the layers of aura and authority embedded in this stone? You could not burn away the dust!
Linden couldn't see Orthos, but he could feel the glare that the turtle directed toward the smug, floating spirit.
Before Linden fixes you, Orthos said, I hope he lets me bite you one time.
Try it, beast. I am only as physical as I choose to be.
Even that conversation tied his stomach in knots, because it reminded Linden that he might not be able to fix Dross. But he distracted himself with the problem at hand.
Orthos, are you suggesting you transfer your power to me?
It hasn't been much use since you outgrew me, but yes, I'll lend you what I can, and then you can send me back to the surface.
It wasn't a terrible idea. Linden still had black flame scales left, but every source of power would be helpful, and he wanted an excuse to send Orthos back anyway. This was a relief. Now, at least, he would be safe.
Are you sure? Linden asked.
Orthos felt the feelings through their bond and let out a heavy breath.
How else am I going to help?
A little irritation slipped into Linden's relief. Not at Orthos, at himself. Hadn't he just said that he wanted to use his power to keep everyone together? And now here he was at the first opportunity letting someone go.
Next time, we won't have to leave you behind, Linden promised. We'll catch you up to us, no matter what we have to do.
This is nice,
Mercy whispered to Yaren.
Quiet! Ethan shouted. They're having a moment!
Orthos ignored them, and Linden felt his fondness in his spirit.
There's no need. I'm content just being along for the adventure.
Linden's feelings firmed.